Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today in our studio by a novelist, mystery writer, mother of four children, recovering attorney and law professor, and the author of a new book about, of all things, LSD, A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life. Ayelet Waldman, thanks so much for joining us on KBOO. Oh,
thank you so much for having me on the show. And you have to forgive me. I lost my voice demonstrating at the airport, so I sound a little scratchy right now.
Well, a very good cause, I have
Absolutely.
To say. I'm going to confess that this is the first book of yours that I've read.
That's okay.
But many of our listeners will know you as a celebrated author, most notably of the Mommy Track Mystery Series.
Oh, those were so far long ago. More people know me from Bad Mother,
was
an essay collection.
A chronicle of maternal crimes and minor calamities and occasional moments of grace.
For sure.
Thank goodness for those occasional moments of grace.
Yes.
You famously said in a New York Times interview back in 2005, I love my husband more than I love my children. And the Oprah Winfrey audience gave you a bit of guff about that.
Yes, they certainly did. They raked me over the coals. And look, it was so long ago, and you and I are still talking about it. So I don't know if I'm ever going to live that down. I'll be pushing, my walker around a geriatric facility, and someone will say, hey, aren't you the one who loves her husband more than her kids?
Well, your husband, here on KBOO, I do talk with a lot of animators and comics artists, so I've read a number of books by Michael Chabon, and that is, he happens to be your husband.
Yes.
The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is a personal favorite.
Absolutely. It's a classic, for sure. Don't you love him more than me? See?
Well, so far, but I think my mind's open right here. So,
you definitely love him more than you love my children.
I haven't met your children. I might think your children are wonderful.
They're lovely.
I would really like to ask you about your legal advocacy, especially your work on behalf of the Drug Policy Alliance. But first, let's talk about your new book, A Really Good Day. Can you tell us what inspired the title?
It was actually really interesting. What happened was I was in the middle of this emotional crisis. I have a mood disorder that I cycle. Similar to bipolar disorder, it's called it PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's like killer hellish PMS. And I was dealing with this. My medications had stopped working, my therapies weren't working, and my mood was plummeting. And I was, noodling around on the internet, as one does. And I saw this interview with James Fadiman, who was a psychedelic researcher in the 60s and has been an author and a professor since then and done all sorts of different things. And Fadiman was describing microdosing, that is, taking a subtherapeutic dose of a psychedelic drug, approximately a tenth of a sort of dose that would make you trip. And he was saying that the people who microdosed would report to him that they had not hallucinated, they didn't see Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, but rather at the end of the day, they would think back on their day and they would say, huh, that was a really good day. And a really good day, I hadn't had one of those in a really long time.
You're very candid, almost confessional, about your history of legal drug consumption, the many pharmaceuticals that you were prescribed in attempt to deal with your mood swings, your hormonal issues, your insomnia.
Right. Yeah, the list of drugs that I've been prescribed it's in paragraph form, not in list form, and it goes on for half a page in the book.
Right.
Everything from Effexor to Celexa to Adderall to Ambien. You name it, I've taken it. My friends think of me as this kind of walking PDR. If they're ever prescribed anything, they call me and they say, tell me everything you need to know about the side effects. And I know it all.
Well, let's go back a little bit. You mentioned subtherapeutic dose. Now, LSD goes back to the 30s, 40s. Albert Hofmann was a Swiss researcher who worked for Sandoz Labs. He lived at the ripe old age of 102. And in the early days, in the 40s and 50s, there were a lot of researchers, and they were giving out big doses that would have people just tripping like crazy. And in fact, LSD researchers often took the drug themselves, occasionally even at the same time as their research subjects.
Frequently. And they frequently came up with their topics of research while they were tripping. It was a different time, let's just say. But in the 30s, when Hofmann synthesized LSD, and then Sandoz eventually realized what they had and started marketing it, what they were saying primarily to psychiatrists, or sort of the equivalent physicians who were practicing psychology and psychiatry at the time, they said to them, and to nurses and to other practitioners, this will help you understand what your psychotic patients are experiencing. If you take this drug, you will have insight into the state of mind of your patients. So really the first people to take it were medical practitioners who were trying to understand the experience of being insane. And as many people who have taken LSD can attest, it does give you that kind of insight. I personally have never taken LSD in a sort of more typical dose. I've only taken these sub-perceptual microdoses.
So you you read this article about James Fadiman, and you wrote to him. He had a memo. He sent you a copy. It was called "To a Potential Self-Study Psychedelic Researcher."
Yes, not something I ever thought that I would be, a self-study psychedelic researcher. But you know, the thing is, as anyone has ever dealt with mental health issues knows, when you are desperate, when you are in pain, when nothing is working, you're willing to try all sorts of crazy things. I mean, you know, what is suicide really except a solution to a terrible problem? Not an acceptable solution, not the solution we want people to take. But when you're in that suicidal state, you are trying to relieve your pain. And the only thing that you imagine that could relieve your pain, or in my case, part of it was I wanted to relieve the pain of my family. I felt like being with me was worse punishment than being without me. Suicide seems like a solution. And so you're willing to, you know, I was searching for a solution, and being a self-study psychedelic researcher seemed at the time to be a better solution than, you know, killing myself.
So your book is very funny. I mean, there's a lot of clinical studies that are mentioned in it. There's a lot of drug policy material in there. But by and large, there's great, funny, personal material in there. And one of those is about how you met a fellow through your contacts at the University of California at Cal Berkeley. And he called himself Lewis Carroll.
Well, we don't know if he was at UC Berkeley. We just know that he was a professor in the Bay Area at some institution. So this is what happened. I thought when I was going to microdose that I live in Berkeley. I thought I was going to, there were rivers of LSD flowing through the neighborhood. I was just going to have to, you know, stick my hand out and it would be, somebody would drop some in my palm. But it turned out that the Venn diagram of Ayelet Waldman, mom of four, and LSD users, I mean, there was no overlap. There was no Venn in that Venn diagram. I didn't know anybody who had LSD. I asked everybody. And eventually a friend said to me, you know, I know a guy who told me once this story about a professor in the Bay Area who's been microdosing for decades, and he's really old now, and maybe he has some left that he's not going to use before he dies. And that just sounded like the most ridiculous story I'd ever heard in my life. So bogus. So such nonsense. So I ignored it. And then one day I went out to my mailbox, and there, you know, between the Victoria's Secret and Bed Bath & Beyond circulars and my utility bill, was this little package festooned with brightly colored, very old stamps, like before forever stamps, and the return address read Lewis Carroll. And when I opened it up, there it was, a little blue bottle. And, you know, I wish he had actually printed out a tiny label that said drink me, but everything short of that. But I don't like, you know, consume things that arrive in my mailbox. But I tested it. I decided I would get an LSD testing kit and I would test it to make sure I knew what it was. And guess where I got my testing kit from?
I've read the book, so I know
this.
Oh,
there you go. Amazon.com. Yes, you too can buy, along with your toilet paper and your half-price books, you can buy LSD testing kits.
Now, I think these are intended for parents who want to find out if their kids are using drugs.
Probably. If they find some substance in their kid's drawer, they want to figure out what it is. So that's probably one of the reasons. And for, you know, police and for, there's, but there is also a community of people who use drugs who want to verify that what they're using is actually safe. So for example, there's a wonderful organization that I love to plug called DanceSafe. And DanceSafe goes to parties and raves and sets up these little booths where they'll test drugs. Because the truth is, the drugs that we know about LSD, it was a surprise to me to find this out, but LSD is actually a very safe drug. Because no one has ever overdosed and died of LSD, we don't even know what the fatal dose is. So LSD is a safe drug, relatively. MDMA is another drug that, compared to other drugs like, you know, Tylenol, is a relatively safe drug. But there are a lot of things that masquerade as ecstasy, that masquerade as Molly, that masquerade as LSD, that are not safe and that are very dangerous. So organizations like DanceSafe set up these little mobile booths at music festivals, and they'll test the Molly, because the idea, this is all about harm reduction. The idea is you want people to know what they're taking so that they can best protect themselves.
So, you know, in the book, on the one hand, you give your readers a sort of don't try this at home message, not the way
I
did.
Yeah, because I don't want to get arrested.
Yeah, on the other hand, you're very explicit about the shortcomings of prescription drugs.
Yes.
And the benefits of microdosing.
Well, there are a lot of people who benefit from prescription drugs, and I don't want anyone who is depressed and who is experiencing a benefit from prescription drugs to stop using them. But in my particular situation, what was prescribed to me was no longer working. By that point, my psychopharmacologist had stopped prescribing because we couldn't find a remedy.
Right.
It was effective.
And there's, at this present moment, there's a lot of anxiety in the air. It's not just a national thing, but global. And the big pharma companies have been cleaning up with their antidepressant and anti-anxiety lines.
Oh, for sure. I don't think there are enough pharmaceuticals in the world to get us to tolerate a Trump presidency. That's grim times.
Let's get into a little bit in your personal experience here. So let's start at day one. So here you are, you're trying your first microdose. It's about a tenth or less.
Yeah, 10 micrograms, not milligrams. If you took 10 milligrams of LSD, you'd be tripping your balls off for a long, long time. Can I say that on the air? But
well,
10 micrograms is a very small, it's a tiny dose. It's nearly homeopathic. I hadn't had any experience with LSD before, and I had all these preconceptions before I began researching it. So even though I had satisfied myself, I had read all of the literature, I had satisfied myself that this was a safe drug, and especially taken in microdoses, I still was really nervous. So I called a friend and had her come over and just babysit me. I don't know what I thought was going to happen. You know, maybe that the wallpaper would start to speak to me or something.
And you had read James Fadiman's book. We mentioned
yes.
James Fadiman earlier. He wrote a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys.
Such an un-Ayala kind of book. I mean, I adore Fadiman. And for someone who's interested in that kind of sacred journey, it's a great book. But I didn't come into this experience from a sort of spiritual place. In fact, I kind of went kicking and screaming to a spiritual place in the book, although I guess I eventually got there in a way. But I was just really interested in the therapeutic value of these drugs.
Well, James Fadiman himself was a very serious clinical researcher.
Absolutely.
And you met him later, and you talk very fondly about him. You seem to count him among the many father figures
yeah.
in your life. I should mention that when he was an undergraduate at Harvard, he was a student of Richard Alpert, who later became known as Ram Dass.
Yeah, and exactly, and Timothy Leary. Richard Alpert slipped Fadiman and Mickey. He slipped him some psilocybin one night in Paris, one afternoon, I believe, in Paris, and that changed Jim's life. I mean, Fadiman is a lovely, lovely man, and he's a very serious researcher. When he was a graduate student at Stanford, he was part of the wave of psychedelic researchers. His particular interest was the effect of psychedelics on creativity, and one of his studies asked the early pioneers of Silicon Valley, this was before Silicon Valley was Silicon Valley, but engineers and researchers in the early days of computers, to bring to this research facility an intractable problem, a problem they'd been working on for a long time. And he and his fellow researchers dosed them with LSD, full-on doses, and then they worked on their problems. They had remarkable breakthroughs. These were problems they'd been working on for months, sometimes even years, and they had breakthroughs under the influence of LSD. They went on to receive patents and publish papers. And, you know, there's a direct correlation between the psychedelic boom and, you know, the little phone you're holding in your hand right now that's
yeah.
connecting you to the internet.
Steve Jobs, who went to Reed College, he considers dropping acid one of the most important things he ever did.
Yeah, and it was seminal in expanding. You know, what it does in the brain is it's LSD and other psychedelics seem to allow different parts of the brain to communicate in unusual and novel ways. And the implications on that for creativity are astounding. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that the book I wrote while I was microdosing is a book that is personal, political, social, funny, that it manages to be at once about the drug war and the racial underpinnings of the what drug war, and about my family's history of mental illness, and it manages to make you laugh. I mean, I do think that there are ways that this drug enhances creativity.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm talking today with Ayelet Waldman. The title of her new book is A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and my life. Yeah, you mentioned Silicon Valley, that the Silicon Valley success stories have a lot to do with psychedelics, big contributing factor. One of the things you write is that today, microdosing has become something of a performance-enhancing mini-trend in the tech world, enough of one to justify an inundation of articles in magazines and online extolling its virtues. I've read a couple, I think it was a New Yorker article about ketamine.
Yes.
And you know, there are some clinical studies these days involving microdoses of psychedelics, but not so much LSD. Ketamine and psilocybin seem to be the drugs of choice,
so
particularly with end-of-life patients.
Nobody's studying microdoses per se, but where they're studying full-on doses. So there's the research that's going on at NYU, Johns Hopkins, UCLA Harbor in Britain. This is research on using, Britain actually has some LSD research, but in the United States, the research is full doses of psilocybin on people who are suffering from anxiety and depression as they face the end of their lives. These are people with fatal illnesses. And the results have been remarkable. These people have, well, I mean, to, you know, put it one way, they end up having a really good death. They are able, after these one or two psilocybin trips, carefully monitored, carefully supported, to come to terms with their deaths, to face their deaths with less fear and less anxiety. So there's a reason that they're using psilocybin and not LSD in those studies. It would be logical for them to use LSD because there's a lot more research on LSD than there ever has been on psilocybin. For decades, LSD was thoroughly researched, thousands of studies. But LSD has a bad reputation. You know, LSD got associated in the mind of the public with hippies and the anti-war movement, and it became vilified as these social movements were being vilified by Nixon, by others in government. And psilocybin, you know, it's a hard word to spell. People don't necessarily know what it is. It didn't have that same kind of condemnation. It didn't have that reputation. So that was the drug that the researchers chose. And it was a purely a political decision, not a medical one.
And it's better known as magic mushrooms.
Exactly.
To some people.
But they're not publishing studies saying magic mushrooms will alleviate your stress and anxiety and your profound depression. They're saying psilocybin, which literally to this day I can't spell.
So you are, here you are, you're following James Fadiman's memo to a potential self-study psychedelic researcher, and it tells you to take a microdose every third day.
Actually, it's every fourth day. You take the microdose on day one, say, which I called microdose day. And then day two, which I called transition day, you're still feeling the effects. Now, again, these are not perceptual. It's not like you're tripping, but you're feeling the positive effects from it, or at least I was. Day three is a reset day. Day three, when I would wake up in the morning on day three, I'd be like, oh, hello, Ayelet. I wasn't as depressed as I'd been before. I wasn't suicidal again, but I wasn't kind of, the cobwebs were back. The sticky gloom was back to a certain extent. Day four, you get to microdose again, and woohoo!
There's some great interactions between you and your husband, and some of the weirder ones take place on day three when you're resetting, when you're not dosing. And the Ambien text message exchange is hilarious, as is the marriage counseling exchange.
When they prescribe Ambien, they always tell you it's not habit-forming, which is such baloney. It's totally habit-forming. And I had formed a serious Ambien habit, not when I was microdosing, but before I had actually gotten off Ambien.
Yeah, you tried to go cold turkey. And that was
yeah,
rough.
That didn't work. At the suggestion of a doctor, I ended up using high CBD, low THC, medically prescribed cannabis, which did get me off Ambien. Whenever I would travel, I would take Ambien, and I would take one, and it wouldn't work, and then I'd take another, and then I would start texting my husband, and with these like lunatic, incoherent texts, and he would be begging me to put down the phone. And the worst thing I ever did was, we have a friend who's a very famous, very beautiful actress who will go unnamed. I took a couple of Ambien on a flight to London and decided that what I needed to do was tell her that if the plane crashed, she should step in and marry my husband and be a stepmother to my children. So when I landed, 12 hours later, there was a confused and suspicious email from this poor woman gently informing me that she had no intention of marrying my husband.
I'm glad you're still friends. This is wonderful.
Yeah,
it probably
she's
helped
very nice. I think she'd had, you know, she'd taken Ambien before too. She knew what it could do. Thank God I didn't tweet. That's all I can say. Thank God I didn't tweet.
So you had some worries along the way. You got a little bit anxious at some of the good things that were coming about from your microdosing. You sort of felt like maybe you were getting too giddy.
There was a couple of days where I experienced what I feared might tumble into hypomania. So if you have a mood disorder, you know that hypomania can be, it's wonderful. I mean, seriously, there's nothing as great as hypomania. I once wrote like 2 books in a month.
Because it's not full-on mania.
No, it's
and
not
you,
mania.
And you don't, you're not going out buying
flat-screen
TVs. Right, you're
not spending $10,000 on flat-screen TVs that you will never use. Hypomania is just this kind of slight exhilaration. But the problem with hypomania is that it can lead to mania. And it is not a time of good judgment. Hypomania is when you, you know, sparkle at a dinner party, but also tell everybody at the party about how you lost your virginity. Not so great. I had a couple of days where I worried that I was about to end up in hypomania. You know, I'd been very discreet about my experience.
You weren't even telling your kids.
I wasn't. No, for sure not. But I wasn't
but
telling
anyone. They were noticing.
They'd had this experience with me before where I tried a new medication and I'd asked them, you know, has it worked? They'd never known something to work so well. So there was definitely, I mean, there was one morning with my daughter. I was like braiding her hair and being so sweet. And I'm not a morning person. And she looked at me and she said, "What is wrong with you? Are you like taking acid?" And I was just like, what? But I confided in my physical therapist about the microdose. I hadn't told my friends, and suddenly I was telling my physical therapist. I thought, oh, no, that's hypomania. But luckily, it didn't get worse than that.
And your physical therapist was treating you for a frozen shoulder.
Yeah. I didn't know about frozen shoulder before I got it. I didn't know that it existed. It sounds like, oh, frozen shoulder, your shoulder hurts. Oh, no big deal. It is unimaginable pain. It is the doctor that I was seeing for told me that it is the worst pain of, he's an orthopedic surgeon, that there's no pain like frozen shoulder in his experience. There were times when I actually would collapse crying on the ground. It is this horrible adhesive capsulitis in your shoulder. It hits people with diabetes and women around their 50th birthday. As if turning 50 didn't suck badly enough, now you have horrible chronic pain, and the pain can last up to 3 years. And when I did this, I think that really was part of my suicidal depression. When you're in chronic pain, with frozen shoulder, it's particularly bad at night. For months and months, I hadn't had a decent night's sleep. I was really in a bad way. I had tried everything to alleviate the pain, and almost nothing worked.
Microdosing?
Until this is studied, I'm not willing to say that it does anything. I'm not willing to say that it solved my suicidal depression and cured my frozen shoulder. What I'm willing to say is this. I was suicidally depressed before I started. I was in agony before I started. I was no longer depressed at the end of the month, and my shoulder had stopped hurting. It is possible that both those things are placebo. It's possible that both those things are coincidental. I'd had the frozen shoulder for about 18 months, and it does tend to resolve in that period. But it was a pretty amazing coincidence and a pretty remarkable placebo effect, if it was one.
And it's really hard to say proven benefits, because every time an LSD study gets going, the feds shut it down.
Although they're not shutting down the psilocybin studies, nor some of the really intriguing MDMA studies that they're doing now with people suffering from PTSD. But if you had asked me on November 8th what I thought of the chances of these studies continuing, of us realizing that there's great medical benefit to psychedelic drugs and alleviating depression and dealing with PTSD and solving problems of chronic pain, in dealing with addiction, which is so important now as we are in the midst of an opioid crisis, I would have told you that we were at the beginning of a revolution in our approach to psychedelic drugs. I don't know what the heck's happening now. Mm. I really don't. I don't think anybody knows. I think that Jeff Sessions is the most retrograde and terrifying attorney general we have ever experienced in decades. I think that this is a man who made a quote unquote joke about how he was totally fine with the KKK until he found out they smoked the devil weed. I mean, think about that. He's a man who has said that no good person has ever smoked marijuana. So if I were someone in the legal cannabis business in the state of California, we just legalized recreational cannabis, I would be very afraid, because I suspect that Jeff Sessions is going to try to make an example out of the legal cannabis business in the state of California. And, you know, there's still mandatory minimum sentences on the books for marijuana, and we still have people serving decades-long sentences for marijuana in this country. Marijuana. Contemplate that.
Yeah, you taught a regular seminar at the UC Berkeley School of Law, The Legal and Social Implications of the War on Drugs. And somewhere along the way, you had a conversation with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow.
Yeah, Michelle came to be a guest lecturer at my seminar for a couple of years. She was great. We called that day The New Jim Crow, and she lectured on the subject of what was to become her book to the students.
She said to you, and I quote, "The war on drugs and the war on crime are the most recent manifestations of an impulse to punish, control, and exploit poor people of color, which will surface repeatedly in our culture until we are willing to face our racial history."
That is absolutely true. I mean, the criminalization of drugs has only and ever been historically a means of controlling and punishing people of color. From the very beginning, what was the first drug law in America?
Well, you point this out, in the late 19th century, the anti-opium laws were aimed at Chinese immigrants, but it was only a certain kind of opium.
Right, so opium in opium dens, Chinese opium dens, that was criminalized. But who were the regular users of opium? Middle-class white ladies who used laudanum, opium dissolved in alcohol. That wasn't criminalized. So it really was Chinese immigration that was criminalized. And we see that again and again popping up. You know, marijuana was tied to the Mexican Americans. So attacks on marijuana were actually attacks on the Mexican American community. The same thing is true about cocaine and African Americans. Again and again, when drugs have been criminalized, it's really been about controlling a certain community.
As you say in the book, as you're hanging on to this vial of LSD, you're a middle-aged white woman with a professional degree and friends in high places. You're not likely to end up in jail for possession of a Schedule I substance.
Yeah, well, that's why I wrote the book. You know, this is a book really about my white privilege. I mean, because I'm a middle-class, middle-aged white lady, because I went to Harvard Law School and graduated with the president, although it's not like he would protect me, but because I am from that background, from that world of privilege, because I have resources, I am much less likely to be prosecuted. Take a young African-American living in Ferguson, who is in the same amount of pain that I was in, who's in more pain, who has horrific PTSD from the violence that he is subjected to at the hands of the police, who is depressed and anxious. That person could not do a 30-day LSD experiment with as much sort of casual confidence that he would not be prosecuted as I had. So, you know, I would never have written a book about, hey, my LSD experience, woohoo. I wrote a book about the history of the drug war and the history of psychedelics. And I wrote a book about how we need to rethink our approach to mental health. And I wrote the book because I can write the book because it's safer for me to write the book. And I believe that if you come from a position of white privilege, the only way to tolerate that is to act on behalf of those who don't, to act in ways that it is more dangerous for them to. So that's the way I stomach leading the privileged life that I lead.
Well, the book is A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life. The author is Ayelet Waldman. Ayelet, it's been fantastic having you here in the studio.
It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to doing it again sometime soon.
So tell us, how can listeners find out more about your work?
So if you go to my website, ayeletwaldman.com, I actually have a lot of resources there to learn more about psychedelics, to learn more about harm reduction, to learn more about not just my books, but other books. So go visit the website. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook, but all you're going to hear is me raging about Trump now and for the foreseeable future. But to learn about my book, go to my website.
And it's Ayelet Waldman, A-Y-E-L-E-T, Waldman.
Yep.
Great. Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. Thanks also to our board engineer, Rock Bergeron, and special thanks today to our intrepid audio editor, Sam Parrish. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/Between the Covers. You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.